Hello and welcome to episode 428 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson and with me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily Podcast. Be LSAT famous. Share news and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. You can also send us a voice recording of your question to help at thinkinglsat.com. Record it in a quiet place and keep it to under 30 seconds if you can. Monday, November 13th, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Is that today? Yes, that's today.
That is today.
Yeah. I'm going to be teaching a class and then on reading comprehension, and then Nathan is going to come in and join at 1:45 p.m. Eastern time. And that class is called The Future of the LSAT. This is going to be for basic, premium, and live students. Yeah. Are you excited to come?
I am always excited to come visit your class. I'm excited to talk to our basic and premium students who we don't get to talk to as often. And I'm excited to talk about the future of the LSAT. So yeah, see everybody there.
Yeah, very cool. Wednesday, November 22nd at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Nathan, your class is available for everyone. So you just have to have a Demon free account to do that class. This was changed from November 23rd. Which I think is Thanksgiving. Yep, that is. So
yeah, anyways, we had stupidly scheduled it, my bad, for Thanksgiving. So we're moving it to the day before Thanksgiving. Hope to see everybody there.
Yep, you can sign up for that at lsat.link/free. Okay, so the October LSAT scores were released last week. Congrats and thanks to all of you who wrote in to share your success stories. We have the first one here from Anonymous.
And by the way, we had lots and lots and lots of these positive ones. We're going to spare you guys and only read you one of them. But we had so many of these positive responses once the October scores came back. And we're going to read some negative ones, too. But here's the positive one. It says, I used the Demon 2 months of live, 1 month of basic to study, and I scored 175 on the October test, which was my first shot at the LSAT. The way you guys and your staff teach just really clicked for me. I love that I didn't have to memorize question types or hacks and could just focus on understanding the test. Thank you times 1,000 for all of your help. Thank you, Anonymous. It really is that easy. I mean, Ben and I, we're working on a book called The LSAT is Easy. We believe that the LSAT is actually easy. And so, yeah, that's why we don't teach a bunch of gimmicks and bullshit. We teach you how to actually understand the test. And when you do, I mean, that's where the high 175 scores come from. So for this, you know, Anonymous could probably score higher if they decided they wanted to take it again. Right? Yeah. And that was just a couple months of studying and one official attempt, and they're already at a 175. It's like, well, okay, you want to shoot for Yale and try for a couple more points? You definitely would be justified if you wanted to do that. If you wanted to just declare victory, that's probably okay too.
Yep. Some of you, as you mentioned, didn't get the score that you were hoping for, Nathan, and let's hear from them. I'm going to read this first one. It's from Anonymous. Okay. The subject is, will a score drop hurt me? Hi, Ben and Nathan. I recently just took my third official LSAT. Sadly, I received my worst score yet, dropping from the 170s back to the 160s. I know schools take my highest score, but I feel like testing worse after a good score might impact my admissions results. Should I pull my applications? Do I need to take this again to prove my highest score?
No.
Ultimately, I'm feeling pretty discouraged. And after a long time of studying, this is the closest I've felt to giving up.
Presumably, you took it again because you thought you could score higher. If anybody ever asked you, why did you take it again? You should say, I thought I could score higher. They're not going to ask you, though. They're going to, in their spreadsheet, they're going to have automatically pulled your highest LSAT. So when they look at you in a spreadsheet or when they look at you in their index formula, only your highest LSAT is going to count in that index formula. They're not then going to go back. I mean, they know what your high LSAT is. So they know what your high LSAT does to their medians. And that's all they care about. They're not going to then look at it and go, oh, but, you know, I'm not sure this person can really cut it in the 170s because they got a 168 on their third attempt or whatever. They don't give a shit. They care that that number represents something on their 509, and only the high number represents anything on their 509.
You know, the phrase that's coming to my mind right now is brass tacks, but why, what does that phrase even mean? Like, I'm not sure that I understand why I'm saying that, but that's what it feels like. It's Like, we're going to move beyond these. What is brass tacks?
The origin of the first phrase, dating from the late 1800s, is disputed. Some believe it alludes to the brass tacks used under fine upholstery. Others that it is Cockney rhyming slang for hard facts. Oh, that's interesting. And still others that it alludes to tacks hammered into a sales counter to indicate precise measuring points.
Hmm.
We do not know. Do you know anything about Cockney rhyming slang?
No.
It's interesting. It's
okay.
Well, this is an example. If this was actually Cockney rhyming slang, it would just be people meant to say that if they were going to say that's just hard facts. But in Cockney rhyming slang, they will say some other thing that rhymes with it to mean that thing. So they would say potentially say brass tacks. I'm trying to think of another example. There are lots of good ones. Anyway.
Yeah. The reason the word came up, though, is that at the end of the day, these nuances, these little things on the side, like, oh, I got a lower score and then I got a higher score, then I got a lower score. None of that matters. We're just going to focus on your highest score, your GPA, and we're going to get down to business and decide whether or not you should come here.
Yep. Apparently, okay. The most famous examples of Cockney rhyming slang. people say brown bread instead of dead. They say
brown
China plate
bread
instead of mate. And they say bubble bath instead of laugh. Apparently, those are popular forms of Cockney rhyming slang.
Wow, I've never said that.
Oh, no. Okay. It's an English thing, so you would have no reason to do that.
Yeah. Okay. This next one is from Anonymous. The subject is Proctor interrupted and lost time. Cancel score? ?
Huh. I had been finally scoring around 172 to 175 consistently on PTs for about 2+ months prior to my first official LSAT in October, which was great to see as I am a splitter. Okay, so bad grades. However, during a scored section on the official exam, my proctor interrupted me. I couldn't see the exam as the time was running and lost about 6 minutes. I got a 168 on the exam, which I understand is a solid score. I also understand schools don't average scores and only have to report the highest score. Yet, oh boy, here it comes, the bad advice from law school admissions folk. Yet, in an info session I listened to, an admissions officer said that they can consider both or multiple scores sometimes, which confused and concerned me. So, should I cancel and retake or keep the score and retake? General thoughts on this conflicting info. This is obviously somebody who paid for score preview, so they got to see their score, and then they have a short window in which to decide whether they want to cancel that score or make it official. I wouldn't cancel here, would you?
No. I mean, so 168 is still an amazing score. And technically what the admissions officer said is not wrong. They can, I want to put air quotes around can, they can consider multiple scores.
They get all of your scores. Those scores might be there on some report somewhere.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, they take the highest one and then they combine that with your GPA. And then they calculate an index and then they rank all of the applicants according to that index.
Yeah.
And so your other LSAT scores are irrelevant to that index. So if you do cancel, it just means you don't have any score that they can put into their index. If you take it again and get a higher score, then it doesn't matter whether you canceled. They're going to use your higher score. You obviously, Anonymous, need to take it again. You were scoring 172 to 175 consistently on your practice tests. Then, yeah, you underperformed on your official test, so you need to take it again. And if there's any law school admissions folk who actually listen to this podcast, I really wish you would stop confusing applicants by talking about how you can't. Yes, I understand that you are legally allowed to and that you do have access to all of their LSAT scores, but be fucking honest with your applicants that you really only care about their highest LSAT score when you're figuring out their admissions case. I mean, you know, or tell them something a little more nuanced, which would be like, well, if your high LSAT matches someone else's high LSAT, then I suppose maybe I might go to, you know, if you were exactly on the bubble, then I might go look at your other LSATs and that might kind of count against you. But that's only going to be the case if someone else matches your high LSAT.
And so, GPA.
And that's your GPA is the same and everything else is the same. I mean, I can see how when you're on the bubble, then everything matters, right?
Yeah.
Everything matters once you're on the bubble. So I could see how that stuff matters. But dude, if you go get your 172 to 175, then you're not on the bubble anymore. Or you're on the bubble at a different school with your 172 to 175. And the 168 doesn't have anything to do with, you know, they don't care because they were already not going to admit you based on your 168. Right. So the idea is your highest one is going to be the first primary, most important thing. And so you just, you got to keep taking it. If you underperformed, you got to keep taking it. Crazy when people don't. It's just insane when people don't. I think that's the most consistent thing, Ben, that we probably say to people who write in or, you know, send us emails or talk to us in class or whatever. It's like, well, do you think how many attempts was that?
Yeah.
Do you think maybe you could take it again?
Yeah.
And people are always like, oh, but I already took it three times. And it's like, I know, but your practice tests indicate you could do better. So there's a lot of upside and no downside for taking it again.
Yep.
All right.
Very cool. This next one, this is a comment actually from Eric. Eric TA'd my class yesterday, and he says, a student in one of Ben's recent classes asked for advice on how to deal with test anxiety. I loved Ben's suggestion. Anticipate potential problems and plan your response. Maybe elaborate on this for the podcast audience. Okay, so one thing I said in class is this person was asking about test anxiety. He said that on his practice test, he didn't feel anxious. And then when he just took the test in October, he was anxious. He didn't perform as well, he thinks, or I guess he must have already gotten his score by that point. And he said, what can I do? And I said, well, one thing I used to talk about a lot, and I haven't talked about it recently, is to tell people to anticipate potential problems and think about what you're going to do in response to that problem. And the example I gave was, imagine, for example, if you encountered a first game that seemed more challenging to you.
Mm.
What are you going to do? And I said that a lot of people, when they hear this advice, they say, that's the last thing I want to do. I don't want to anticipate problems and then increase my anxiety. But I do think if you anticipate problems and then also think about what you're going to do about them, your anxiety can go down because you already have a plan in place for what's going to happen in that situation. I think a lot of the anxiety comes from the unexpected nature of some of these problems, right? They happen and people are like, oh no. And as I was going on to another example, he said, wait a sec, that's the problem I had. The first game in the game section was hard for me and I panicked and I started thinking about like, oh, I should be doing better on this game. It's the first game. I'm not going to do well in this section. And if I'm not going to do well in this section, how am I going to do well on this test? And the test sort of unraveled from there for him. I think that's a super common scenario. And it doesn't hurt to just think, okay, like actually these things aren't as big of a deal as you think they are. And one way to do that is actually to lean into them, not to run away from them and pretend that they don't exist.
Yeah. It reminds me of what very little I know about Stoicism, which Stoicism, the philosophy, one of the things as I understand it is to imagine the worst that could happen.
Mm.
And you do that in advance. You don't wait until you're having a disaster. You think about it ahead of time. And so sometimes I think they get, you know, accused of being morbid. It's like, you know, Ben, you would think about what happens if your house burns down with all your kids inside.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, okay, that's obviously a horrible, tragic thing. We don't want to be dwelling on those things. We don't want to think about those things all the time. But I guess the idea is that it's a way of like resetting your happiness, resetting your expectation.
Sure.
Like resetting your status quo. Cause if you think about that horrible situation of your kids burning to death in the house, then it's like, oh, these, you know, whatever troubles I'm having getting my microphone to work at the beginning of the podcast. It's like, okay, maybe that's not that big of a deal anymore. It kind of seems adjacent to that, but I really do. Yeah. I like this idea that, think it through. What are the things that might be horrible?
Mm-hmm.
What other things might happen horribly on the day of the test? Distraction from the proctor.
Yeah, 100%. We've already heard
about that today.
Yep, yeah. The proctor gives you trouble. The test doesn't start on time. The proctor makes you look around the room. Same sort of thing. The second reading comp passage seems extraordinarily dense to you. You get stuck in some answers early on in logical reasoning. Question 7 just throws you for a loop. None of these things are insurmountable. In fact, the solution is almost always the same. Just take a deep breath and either continue with the question or go on to the next one and be done with it.
But the thinking about it in advance might shortcut that a little bit, where you go, oh, I knew that this was possible. I knew that I could get a nasty game 2 or a nasty question 7 or a proctor who was a pain in the ass. I knew that these things might happen, and you kind of rehearse them in advance. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to take a deep breath. Close my eyes maybe for 5-10 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm just going to go back and I'm going to reread the sentence that I was reading and understand it as best I can, because that's all you can ever do on the LSAT.
Yep. Yeah. And worst case scenario, take the test again, right? Like, there's always a solution. I think that avoiding these is what gives them power. That's something that you always talk about, and I like it, that we don't want to give the test more power than it has, which is not very much. I mean, it helps determine your application and so forth, but it's something that you can certainly be the boss of rather than it being the boss of you.
Totally.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, this next one is from Audrey. The subject is review/mistake.
Audrey says, I recently started studying for the LSAT. I don't have a set date yet on when I will be taking it, earliest 2025.
Whoa.
But I do have a target score and I won't be stopping until I get that score. Typically, I drill for an hour or so before classes during the week, and I complete timed sections on the weekend. I review after each question and section, and definitely have noticed I've started to pick up on key things. However, I was wondering if you guys have any tips on how to internalize mistakes. I usually get wrong answers right during blind review and can point out why I got it wrong the first time. But from there, I get sort of lost. I'm just not sure how I should be internalizing my mistakes so I don't make them again. Additionally, what practice tests should I take? All the full-length practice tests I've come across have logic games, but since I won't be taking that section, I feel it's best to only focus on the sections I will be taking. Maybe we could address that last one first.
Yeah, you can take any of the... Well, actually, there's two tests in the Demon that you can't take as tests because they have only one logical reasoning section. That's test, I think, 90 and 92. But all the other tests we now have set up so that you can just take them in the new format. You turn off logic games on the advanced settings page, and then you can take the test. It will give you the two LR sections and the reading comp section in whatever order they were on the original test. And then you'll get a graded score, a 120 to 180 score, based on the new score conversion tables. So.
Sweet. So that's already built into the Demon. Do people have to look for it? This is the toggle, right?
Yeah. They click on their profile, then they click on the advanced settings tab, and it's right up there at the top. It says logic games, and you just turn it to no. You say no logic games, and the Demon will magically turn into a new tool that is preparing you for the August 2024 test or later. Audrey says here that she's not going to take it until the earliest 2025. To me, that seems a little far out for someone who's studying right now. But
if Audrey knows that that's what she wants to do, I mean, yeah, Audrey, I would say that if you hit your practice scores sooner than that, there's really no reason not to just take the LSAT. The LSAT's just another practice test. So if you can do your studying and do your timed sections while you're still in school, it sounds like you're in school, which, by the way, make sure you're getting straight A's. That's like rule number one. If you're still in undergrad, get straight A's. If you're doing that and you're still studying, then there's no reason why you can't also take the official test. I mean, that's just, you know, a few hours on a Saturday, and it's not, you know, you treat it just like it's any other practice test. You don't have to do anything different, nothing special. So don't like give the test. Like, that's an example, isn't it, Ben, of people giving the official test potentially too much power?
Exactly.
Don't give them too much power. Instead, just, you know, monitor your practice test scores. If your practice test scores are good, then think about taking an earlier test. But I do think that if you're pretty confident that you're not going to take it before August of 2024, then you should go into your advanced settings and say no to games. And then the Demon instantly is just a no logic games tool, and you can do all your tests and everything.
Yeah.
One thing I want to say about the internalizing mistakes.
Sure.
I don't think people need wrong answer journals. I don't think you need to go back and re-review old questions that you've already reviewed. I think that you need to review them once, learn what you can learn, and then move on. I don't think you need to keep a journal of that. I don't think you need to take notes. I think that you need to instead focus intensely on that mistake. And you say, Audrey says, I can point out why I got it wrong the first time. I want you to go a little deeper on that. And I want you to divide that into two mistakes, because you had to make two mistakes to miss that question. It's not just one reason why you got it wrong. It's at least two reasons why you got it wrong, because you picked a wrong answer. How do you avoid picking that wrong answer? How could you have avoided picking that wrong answer? Why did you pick that wrong answer? What did you misunderstand that made you pick that wrong answer? And then totally separately, how did you not pick the right answer? And I think that what Audrey might be doing is falling into this trap of like, oh, I did it on blind review. I got it right on blind review. I see why the right answer is right. Yeah, I get it. That other answer is just not as good, or something like that. And then you move on. And instead it's like, no, that wrong answer is 100% wrong. Why is it wrong? But why didn't you see why it was wrong? And then why is the right answer right? But then also, why didn't you see that it was right? And if you do those things, then I think that's about all the internalization you need. I don't know that you need to do any more than that. I would probably just move on, but I want to hear what you have to say, Ben.
Yeah, I actually have something similar to say, because when Audrey said, I usually get wrong answers right during blind review. Great, I'm glad that you are, but it seems like she's giving too much weight to that. Like, oh, I got it right, and therefore I'm doing this review process. That's really so secondary to me. It's like, I'm glad you redid it and that you got it right, but I'm not looking to that to decide whether or not you understand it. What I want you to be able to do, and when you say internalize, this is what I'm thinking. I want you to be able to turn around and verbally explain this question to somebody else. And when you start doing that, when you start walking through the logic, it's going to clarify the logic for you, right? And you probably be just talking to yourself because no one else is in the room, but just go through that exercise of explaining it clearly to some imaginary person. As you do so, that will clarify it for you. That's step one, right? Now you understand why this answer is wrong. And as you just said, why that wrong answer is wrong. But then the next part of that, and this is where I think people struggle, but can you explain to that same imaginary person why you didn't understand that the first time?
Yeah. What was it that attracted you to the wrong answer, and how do you see it differently now? What was it that repelled you from the correct answer, and how do you see that differently now?
Yeah.
Like, what
has
was
changed?
It? Yeah. What was it that you had been misreading? And frequently it's multiple things. You can misread the passage. You can misread the question. You can misread the wrong answer that you pick. You can misread the right answer that you don't pick. It's probably some of that going on in most of your mistakes. But yeah, if you could explain it to, you know, if you could tell me, well, I picked this, but now I see why it's wrong. This is why it's clearly wrong. And the reason why I picked it was this, but now I see that that reason isn't enough. You know, that's not a good reason.
Yeah.
And then this other answer that I didn't pick, I can see why it's right. Here's how it answers the question. And the reason why I didn't pick it was, yeah, there was this phrase that I didn't like that word, but now I understand that if I interpret that word in this way, then that answer makes perfect sense. I totally get it.
Yeah.
If you do that, then I think you're done. I just don't think you need to dwell on it. We got 5,000 logical reasoning questions to work on. So I think you can just move forward.
Yeah. I think you've internalized it. I'm going to say one last thing, then we can move on. But the one analogy here is that our written explanations or our video explanations are that first step, right? They're explaining why the wrong answers are wrong and why the correct answer is correct. And you want to be able to get to a point where you can verbalize our written explanations in a way that makes sense to you. The second step is something that's not in the daemon, but it's an analysis of yourself. What the fuck did I do to get me into this mess? And that can be tricky, but if you can do that, then you're also going to, I think, make progress faster as you go into the next questions because you're catching your process that's wrong.
For sure. I'd rather you do that on one question than just, you know, half-ass blind review five questions where it's like, well, I got it right the second time through. And yeah, okay, I can see how that makes sense. Like, that, moving on.
Yep.
Nah, let's go deep on one of them. Because otherwise, you're just going to keep making the same mistake over and over. And I can't say this often enough. Half of your mistakes or more are from simply misreading things.
Yep.
So this thing came from Leslie. She's our personal statement editor. She does a great job helping people polish up their documents. And according to Leslie, some people are now calling diversity statements, quote, lived experience essays. This reflects the new language that some law schools are using in their applications in the, post-affirmative action era, if we want to call it that, post-Dobbs decision. Oh, wait, no, Dobbs was abortion. what was the decision again? Oh, Harvard and UNC decision where they got rid of those, they got rid of the, you know, like explicit affirmative action programs. So we have an example here, Ben, and I'll let you read it. And then Leslie did some research into this phrase, lived experience. Go ahead.
Okay. Penn Carey Law is committed to achieving an expansive and inclusive law school community that brings a diverse range of ideas, experiences, and perspectives to our classrooms. Tell us how your lived experience informs who you are today. Okay.
So that's the actual prompt for something that used to be called maybe a diversity statement. It does still say diverse range of ideas, experiences, and perspectives. And so it's obviously now, you know, it's like less explicitly about race. They don't want it to be explicitly about race because that's what the Supreme Court got mad about.
Yep.
And they're going to ask you about diverse experiences.
And ideas and perspectives.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, this term, lived experience, appeared in two of the dissents, at least in that Supreme Court case. You want to read those excerpts?
Yeah, for sure. It and apparently did not appear in the majority opinion, but they're just trying to capture, I think, the idea. Maybe Jackson, Justice Jackson said, although formal race-linked legal barriers are gone, race still matters to the lived experiences of all Americans in innumerable ways, and today's ruling makes things worse, not better.
So that's just complaining that race is important.
Yep. And that was Justice Jackson. And then Justice Sotomayor says, she mentioned this in a footnote, a finding that, quote, UNC rewards different kinds of diversity and evaluates a candidate within the context of their lived experience. Okay. So people have picked up on this term.
Yeah. And it does seem like law schools are, you know, the ruling didn't provide, I mean, it struck down what Harvard and University of North Carolina undergrad, by the way, it struck down what those two schools were doing.
Yep.
Whether that mean, you know, how much that touches other schools just have to try to, you know, do what they wanted to do without running afoul of this new interpretation. And so it seems like they've latched onto this lived experience idea. Remember, though, that, you know, Justice Roberts did snap back on them. Is that the right phrase? Clap back on them in the majority opinion, saying explicitly that the dissent is usually not a good place to go looking for legal guidance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think what actually happened here is they're saying things about lived experiences that they disagree with when it comes to the majority. But even though the majority didn't use that phrase, I think that's what Roberts was talking about. He's like, hey, you can talk about your lived experience, just don't explicitly make it all about race. Or,
well, it's that you can't just say I'm black, therefore I, you know,
that's enough. Yeah.
Right. It, which obviously no one was ever doing in the first place. It's just that, you know, the thing that really ran afoul.
System, yeah.
Well, right. That Harvard LOP list that they had was just fucking, that was just a joke, right? I mean, that was like so ridiculous where they were making it explicitly a thing where they were like, well, okay, we have to cut half of this group, right? This group, we only have seats for half of this group.
Yep.
We have to cut half of them. And then they made race like one of the first things where it was like, well, we're not going to cut people who are from diverse racial backgrounds. And this, the court was like, well, you clearly can't do that. But people talking about race in their essays, of course you can talk about what it means to be Black and how that experienced your life. And so, yeah, I mean, honestly, I think a lot might change in the background of what the schools are going to do. I'm not sure that much has to change in terms of what students want to do on their diversity statement.
It's just it's like reframing, but similar.
That's
discussion.
What they were already doing. They were they're clearly talking about their life as a Black person or a whatever diverse background person. That's what everybody has always been doing on their essays anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of that one.
Yep. So now we have some GPA related questions. The first one is from Daniel.
Daniel says, my GPA was 2.94 and my family and I were going through financial and horrible hardships with my absent father. I also work two jobs and help my mom raise my 12-year-old sister along with my other sister who helps. If I write a strong addendum, will it help my case when applying to law school if I get a high 150s, low 160s LSAT?
I think an addendum talking about how much work you were doing could be helpful. I don't know if I would blame your father or things like that. I would just say, hey, while I was doing school, I had to work a certain number of hours per week to help my family's financial situation.
And that'll help you when you're being compared against someone else who also has a 2.94 and a high 150s, low 160s.
Yeah.
It's just not going to matter when you're getting compared against somebody who has a 3.5 and a 165. Like you're not even in there. That's not the same planet.
Yep.
So like, you just got to be honest about what an addendum can actually do. An addendum is if you're on the bubble, if they've already decided that you're barely going to squeak into this school, then the addendum might make them look at that and go, oh yeah. Okay. So this person, maybe their grades were, they could have done a lot better. But just get a 168 and then they'll know that you could have done a lot better.
Yeah. Daniel, I wonder what your diagnostic was or why you're sort of kind of capping your score at high 150, low 160.
Right.
Shoot higher. I think that's something that a lot of people struggle with at first. They take the test, they get a 144. They take the test, they get a 152 and they think, okay, if I could just eke out another 10 points, it's like, yeah, you can get that. You can probably get a lot more too, because a lot of people do, and they just don't realize that yet. And so they have to kind of change their vision for how much they can improve.
Keep in mind. Yeah. Well, totally agree. 100%. Don't sell yourself short. The LSAT is the wrecking ball. It's the thing that's going to really make a difference. If you think that your addendum is like equally important to the LSAT, that's I'm sorry. No, you need to think about the LSAT because that's the thing that's going to really change the game. The other thing I would recommend, Daniel, everybody else with a 2.94 is also writing that exact same addendum or, similar. I was working three jobs and taking care of my kids, or I was 19 and I didn't know what was going on in my life, or I'm first generation and, or I started out pre-med, or whatever. Like everybody has reasons why they have their bad grades. and everybody thinks that addendum is going to make a difference, but honestly, they're going to be comparing you against somebody else who has the same grade, same GPA or same LSAT and probably the same addendum. So it's like, yeah, you should do it, but don't worry about it. Cause the LSAT is the thing that really is going to make the difference. Yeah. Aaliyah apparently has a 2.3 GPA. What's she have to say?
I had a 3.4 GPA before everything hit the fan. My father passed away at the time, and my mom opened up a business out of sheer survival. Instead of taking time off from school, I thought I could help run my mom's new business, work a full-time job, and go to school full-time and be just fine. Well, obviously it didn't work out, but I do not regret it. Her business is cashing in great money, and she is now financially stable from all the work she and I put in. Anyways, I'm wondering if I should get my master's to prove my academic capabilities.
Absolutely not.
No, wow. It's an expensive, time-consuming journey. Or if I should just study my hardest for the LSAT and apply. Thanks, exclamation point. Option two, door two. Take that and run.
Yeah, or door zero, which is give up on law school and just work in your mom's business. I mean, having a thriving business is way more attractive than like going and trying to grind it out in law school with hopes of getting a high salary job.
Fair, fair. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to play in this game.
You do not have to play in this game. If you do want to play in this game, then your LSAT is going to be the thing that's going to really get you into the conversation. No one's going to give a shit about any of these stories unless you have the right LSAT, is what I'm saying. Like, you're just, your LSAT's going to open up the conversation.
That reminds me of our GLAAD acronym, right? First focus on GPA, then focus on LSAT, then focus on applying early and broadly, and finally decide whether you're going to go to law school. And notice that the decision to go to law school comes after you get all these offers and whether they're good or not. It also comes, and I think this is really important, they come after you've settled on an LSAT score. Sometimes I think people look at the LSAT as like a burden or a thing they have to get through to get to what they want, law school. But flip it and look at the LSAT as this great light bulb. It's like it's going to shine a light on whether you're really made for this kind of work. And if the answer is you're not, don't get upset, but actually be like, thank you. Okay, I just avoided wasting a lot of money and time and most likely a fairly miserable career until I finally decided to get out and do something else.
And before everybody gets so pissed off at us and, you know, we don't think the LSAT's an aptitude test, because people can improve by 25 or 30 points sometimes. Mm-hmm. And even higher sometimes. I think that we have one student who's knocking on the door of a 40-point increase.
Yeah,
and
we're watching that like, one. Yep.
You know, okay, so if you're capable of that, then you're capable of succeeding in law school. But mm-hmm. if you're not, like if you start really low and you don't improve, then yeah, I think you should do what Ben says, which is you should look at that and go, oh, maybe this is a gladiator arena that I don't really want to step into. Because the LSAT is like the preliminary trials of the English language gladiator arena that you're going to be in law school, which, by the way, that's the junior varsity gladiator. Because then when you get into legal practice, now you're in the varsity gladiator practice.
Yeah.
And if you were really struggling on the, you know, warm up junior high gladiator practice that the LSAT is, then you're not going to have a good time in law school or legal practice.
Well, keep in mind, too, when you get into legal practice, you're still on the bench. You're just support.
Yeah, you know, you're the JV. Yeah, that's true. You're the practice squad for the real team. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Anyway, we'll work on that metaphor a little bit. Aaliyah, you need to work on your LSAT. Like the LSAT's the thing that's going to really matter. One last thing for Aaliyah. When you say, I have no regrets, I'm glad you have no regrets. But that's a thing that I would definitely keep out of all of your essays. Because the law schools are going to look at that as a bad decision. Like, you made a bad decision to go to school full time and work full time and help your mom's business. That's the way they're going to see it. Because to them, academia is the most important thing.
Yep.
So if you're not excelling in academics, then like doing shit like this is the type of thing that people do who don't excel in academics.
Well, and they excel so well in other things because they're not just bookworms, right? They're getting shit done.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to attack Aaliyah. I'm just saying the scoreboard shows a 2.3 and like you put that there. No one else put that there. So, and I'm not blaming you for making the decision. I made dumb decisions when I was a naive undergrad as well. I'm just telling you that from their perspective, they're going to look at that and go, oh yeah, that's unfortunate. Like that's, you know, boy, 2.3. Ooh, I don't know if this person really is able to prioritize academic endeavors enough to succeed in our school.
Yep.
That's the way they're going to perceive it.
Yeah.
Again, you know, you can definitely write an addendum to say I was working full time and helping my mom start a new business. You know, that's why I had a 3.4 before that. But if you show up with, you know, not a stellar LSAT, then you're just not bringing anything to the table that they can use.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, thanks for writing in. Let us know how that goes and keep us posted. This next one is from Jay. The subject is GPA, high versus low ranked schools, business school, : downward GPA curve ? I don't follow.
Two colons in the same subject. That's a lot. Yeah. Okay. Do law schools take into account positively the GPA of a student from a higher ranked school versus a lower ranked school? Or would law schools rather accept a person at a lower ranked school who has a 4.0 over someone at a higher ranked school with a 3.6? I'm a business major and the college implements a downward curve on all classes in order to regulate a B to B plus average for all students. This curve makes it difficult for me to compete in my math based classes like accounting, finance, etc. Why would that matter? I thought they were all curved. Why is it harder for you to compete in math because of the curve? I don't understand that part. Is this the type of information to put into an addendum? Well, not that confusing part about how it makes it more difficult for you to compete in your math classes. That seems like you're making an excuse. Like, oh, it's the curve. That's why.
Oh,
I'm not.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like math. Yeah.
I would just say my GPA has suffered because of this mandatory curve.
Yep.
It will be seen as an excuse if you do it the way you were going to do it. My poor performance in my business classes has been a great detriment to my overall GPA, 3.6, with my Spanish major currently a 3.8, saving me.
Yeah. I mean, I would just state the facts. I wouldn't say much more than that because it's still an excuse. Like, you're not.
Stop taking those classes. What are you doing? Is that a minor or something?
Oh, yeah. Good point.
Oh, no, I'm a business major.
Huh?
Oh, but you're also a Spanish major.
Okay, stop. It's a dual major.
Yeah.
Why are you doing two majors?
How serious are you about law school? That's the question. If you're serious about law school, like you know that it's law school or bust for you, I would drop the business major and just get A's. Because I think that they're going to. You know, yes, they do care about the difficulty of majors. Yes, they do care about the difficulty of schools, but they have a real hard time making that translation. They have a number. The LSAT gives them a number. They have their LSAT, your LSAT number and your GPA number. You can write an addendum. You need to focus on your LSAT. Yep. Sorry for being a broken record.
Well, focus on your GPA now.
Oh, that's true. You're still an undergrad. Why are you talking to us? I mean, like, yeah, like forget about the LSAT for now. Get A's. And if that means drop those business classes that have too harsh of a curve. I worry that undergrad, like some undergrad programs seem to be like shooting themselves in the foot by doing this to their undergrad students.
Yeah.
If you go to a school that has like a well-known tough grading curve, I'm thinking of, I believe Reed College is like known that everybody there gets bad grades. Then I think the law schools might take stuff like that into account.
Even then though, it's gotta be tough for the school to do
so,
right?
For them to do it. I know.
Because they're admittedly accepting people who have a lower GPA. So they're going to pull down their 509 data.
Yeah. It makes their public data look worse. It lowers their ranking in US News. So, you know, they have to be thinking that they're really getting somebody who's going to raise their ranking in U.S. News in other ways. LSAT is one obvious way. If you can raise it with your LSAT, then great. Then that's going to counterbalance your low GPA. Otherwise, it's like all these really ephemeral, you know, like they would be betting on your employability or something like that. Like, oh, this person has a business major and they went to a school that had a hard grading curve. But that business major and that rigorous undergrad, that's going to make them more employable, and that's going to help our rankings.
Yeah, tough.
Tough. It's tough to see them making that decision. I mean, again, like I hate to say everything comes down to LSAT and GPA, but I think in broad strokes, everything comes down to LSAT and GPA.
Their numbers. You're competing with, intangibles.
What can they put in a spreadsheet?
Yep.
And they can't put that curve of your business classes into their spreadsheet, so I just don't think in broad strokes, I don't think it matters. Like if you apply to 15 schools, I think it probably didn't matter to 14 of them. I think that's it.
Yeah.
For our scheduled content.
Wait, do we want to talk about this shout out?
Oh yeah. Shout outs. Why don't you read this one? This is from a review of Callie's class. It's called LSAT Translation Reading Comprehension. Why don't you read this review of Callie?
Yeah. So the feedback is rating 5. That's 5 out of 5. The comment is, I love Callie's way of explaining RC and LR, reading comp and logical reasoning. She is very thorough and naturally explains the reason why you might be tempted by an answer and quickly points out why it is the incorrect answer in an easy to understand way. She breaks down passages and the stimulus into simple translations. The stimulus, by the way, is just the question. I haven't been able to attend any of her live classes, but I have watched the recordings and love them. A fantastic tutor that makes RC and LR easy. Callie is my favorite RC tutor on the Demon and a great addition to the Demon's fantastic LR tutors. Wow. Okay. Well, thanks.
Thanks for that review, Callie. Yeah. Thanks for doing a great job. I think we should do a second shout out here, Ben, to Abigail and the development team for getting the no games toggle up and running so quickly.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That was an effort, as these things are. They always sound easier than they are until you start doing them. And yeah,
it didn't sound easy to me. I mean, what we're talking about here is a toggle that turns off all of the logic games, everything in the entire LSAT daemon. It's this global big thing. Mm-hmm. And Abigail worked miracles over the weekend, it sounds like, to make that happen.
She did. Yep. So thanks to her and to the devs and to Jen and Chris for helping to get that all going. Yeah.
Excellent.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us at Thinking LSAT. If you have questions about LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 428 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing ya. Don't pay for law school.